Good morning and welcome to Our American Heritage. I am Arch Hunter, the host of the program. Our American Heritage is a program where we explore in depth the American experience from its beginning through the present. And we are talking about the Siege of Boston and the importance of the Siege of Boston, the players in the Siege of Boston, the military players or leaders in the Siege of Boston, how it happened, why it happened, the background going all the way back to the French and Indian War and working forward about how this anger towards of the colonists towards the British Parliament and the King and then vice versa, how this ultimately got us to the American Revolution with the different acts that the Parliament tried to pass on to record, to receive money to pay for the French and Indian War. The British government was pretty bankrupt. The colonists thought it was tremendously unfair that they should pay taxes without being represented. And the Parliament kept saying, well, 90% of the British don't have representation because they're not landowners. Well, here, it was opposite. 90% of the colonists, particularly in the Boston area, were landowners. So we have these clashes going on between the British government wanting the colonists to pay some taxes because it's bankrupt, and one of the reasons that it was bankrupt because of the French and Indian War, and the colonists wanted representation in Parliament, which they were not going to get. So that's broadly what happened in the background. And then we looked at some of the different acts that the British put on the colonists to help to force them in the direction of the British government. And the more they pushed, the more the colonists pushed back, which eventually got us to Lexington and Concord, which then got us to the Siege of Boston, which got us to the First Continental Congress, and making George Washington the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army and sending him up to Boston now to create this army, because we are going to take on our country and we're going to break from them and have our own government through this rebellion. And I had talked about in the just got to the point where I was sharing a little bit about Henry Knox and his background as a bookstore owner, an ardent reader, didn't have any military background other than he was involved in, on some level, a small militia, never even had fired a musket, but he had read about artillery and firing a musket and pistols. And one day he was trying to teach himself how to fire a pistol, and he unfortunately shot off two of his fingers on his left hand. He eventually gets out to Washington at his headquarters, and General Washington hires him to lead the artillery through knowing and understanding books. The problem was there was no artillery at that point in the American Revolution, which isn't part of our story. Another player for the colonists and the militia was Dr. Joseph Warren, who played a significant influence, well-respected Bostonian, as a doctor and as one of the leaders of the Sons of Liberty, and did a tremendous amount to support the Sons of Liberty, to continue to help support the American Revolution. He was 100% in favor of declaring our independence from Great Britain. And unfortunately, we see Joseph Warren deciding to get himself out to Breed's Hill. And there he is killed. His body is mutilated. And several days later, his body then is finally recognized by Paul Revere by doing a dental record, which is just a fascinating story at this point. So finally, what gets us to the place where the militia, the Bostonian militias, the Massachusetts militia, believe that we should have the Siege of Boston. And the British are in trouble, because if you know geographically Boston, it's a peninsula. And the only thing that connects us to land was this little isthmus that comes down, which most people call the gooseneck. And to get out of Boston on land, you had to come down this little piece of land that was not very wide, and it was somewhat swampy, to get out into the main part of a continent. So the British are in Boston, and they have nothing. There's really nothing they can do but then try to protect Boston. Again, not realizing ultimately what was going to happen at this point. So when this Continental Congress meets, and they first meet in September, what they decide to do, or what is their problems at this point? What are the problems that the colonists are facing at this point? One, the colonists have no military. How are you going to take on the British? They're the superpower of the day. Two, there is no weapons. You have your own musket. We have no supplies. How are you going to maintain militias ultimately becoming an army with no supplies? You don't have a commanding officer. Who's going to command, oversee all these militias ultimately becoming an army? Who's going to do that? And there is no full support from the other colonies. There's nothing happening in New York. There's nothing happening in Pennsylvania as far as these confrontations with the British military. There's nothing going on here in the other colonies. And the farther south you go, there is not a lot of support at this point for a confrontation with the Crown at this point. So the militias and the Bostonian and Massachusetts citizens have tremendous problems that they really haven't even thought through. On the other hand, what are some of the British problems? Well, the British are trapped in Boston. The only way that they can get out of Boston is to march out of Boston. And coming down that gooseneck would be suicide for them at this point. So they set up barriers. They set up little forts all the way around Boston to protect themselves. So they're trapped in Boston. The military, the British military has no idea how to fight a war except for the old European style of fighting. Militia fights guerrilla war. The British also have a major problem. As we all know, if you're going to have a military, you need to supply them. The British have no supply bases. That's in England. So now they're going to have to bring a tremendous amount of supplies over from Great Britain and begin to have supply bases here, which is a major problem for the British. They also don't have a lot of manpower here. How are the British going to control the colonies militarily? You have 13 different colonies that stretch for a long, long miles, over 1,500 miles down the coastline. The British do not have enough military to control all these colonies militarily like they could in Europe. Because in Europe, you control land by having forts. In the colonies, that's not going to work. So the British don't have enough military manpower. The British have about 43,000 soldiers in all their military at this point. And by this point, there's approximately 5,000 in the Boston area. Well, what about the rest of their empire? Though the British don't have enough support manpower-wise militarily. And their other problem, which at both colonists, the Continental armies, and the British had major difficulties with, more for the British, is their communication. 6 weeks to communicate with Parliament and the King. How is that going to transpire when you need to make decisions day by day and quickly as this is unfolding? So what the British do is, under Thomas Gage, they simply fortify themselves surrounding Boston on the land, in this little city of Boston. They fortify Boston, hoping and thinking that more manpower is going to come in, and they're going to get supplied from the ocean, and they're hoping, Thomas Gage is hoping, that this will all calm down, cooler heads will prevail, military confrontations will not be ongoing or increasing at this point. But the problem is, the Crown has now been totally embarrassed with the colonists having nothing to do with these different acts. The Crown has been embarrassed with the Boston Massacre. The Crown has been totally embarrassed with the Boston Tea Party. Even more embarrassed now with this situation that happened out at Lexington and Concord. The Crown knows that they cannot allow the colonists to get away with these activities, because if the colonists did, other colonies or other land masses throughout the world that the British were controlling then could possibly do the same things, and then the British Empire would disintegrate. So the Crown knows that something serious needs to take place to stop this at this point. They don't know how. That's another situation. How did they do this? So as the British then fortify the areas around Boston under Artemus Ward, which I talked about, what the militia starts to do is began to fortify Cambridge and Charleston. And then they're going to fortify Breed's Hill, which is above Charlestown. Breed's Hill is 110 feet above sea level. So the militia decided they're going to come down and they're going to put a redoubt, not on Bunker Hill, but on Breed's Hill. They're going to be up on Bunker Hill, which is 110 feet, come down and build this redoubt, which is a type of fort to defend it's a military defensive position. So in June 17th, the militia comes down to Breed's Hill, which is 40-some feet below Bunker Hill, and throughout the night, they build this redoubt. And it's only 400 yards from the shoreline at Charlestown across to Cobb's Hill. So you all night long, the British can hear what's going on over there. And when the sun comes up, they see that the militia has been building a redoubt on Breed's Hill. And so what Thomas Gage decided to do, they're going to bring a military force across the Charles River. They're going to disembark in the lower part, and they're going to have frontal assaults up onto this redoubt, which is up on Breed's Hill. All morning long, they have to wait for high tide. So it takes a large majority of the morning and part of the afternoon for the British to disembark their soldiers at the base of the Charles River. And the British are under the command here of General William Howe. And so what happens is when the British finally get all their men ashore and form their lines, they start marching up side by side to have a frontal assault onto this primitive redoubt on Breed's Hill. And there's about 270 militia inside of this redoubt on Breed's Hill. And the British have this peninsula surrounded on both sides with ships, but they're not able to fire cannons because of the angle at this point. And as well as, it's a bit of arrogance here that the British think that they're going to use their military might strategy of having frontal assaults, open field frontal assaults on this primitive redoubt that are by militia. So William Howe has three frontal assaults onto this redoubt on Breed's Hill. And with the third frontal assault, the militia finally runs out of ammunition. A lot of them run back up to retreat up to Breed's Hill. Many of them are killed. Joseph Warren is killed in this redoubt. But the British have finally, after three frontal assaults, they have taken the redoubt on Breed's Hill, but at terrible losses, at absolutely terrible losses. Breed's Hill is the single bloodiest battle in the American Revolution. General Howe had 1,200 casualties. General Howe lost 44% of his men, and he lost 89 officers, having three frontal assaults on Breed's Hill. The British win Breed's Hill, but at what cost? And Howe never has a frontal assault on Washington troops. He always tries to use, from that point on, a flanking maneuvers. But it's tremendous, tremendous loss for the British at this point. General Howe's men and the loss of his men and officers. The British take Breed's Hill. They see a tremendous amount of men, militia, up on Bunker Hill. They don't pursue. They go up to Bunker Hill at all. So what they do is they simply withdraw and go back into Boston. So basically, what have they done? They took a redoubt. They didn't hold the land. They have tremendous losses. They go back inside. They withdraw back into Boston. They're not going to attack Bunker Hill. General Gage is relieved of command. General Howe then is elevated to be the commanding officer of the British inside of Boston. And meantime in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress has met in May of 1775, and they make several decisions. One, they're going to create a Continental Army. Two, they're going to create Continental Currency. Three, they created a spy network. Four, they're ultimately going to write the Declaration of Independence a year later. And then fourthly, they appoint General George Washington to be commander of the Continental Army. So Washington, and all the reasons why, one of them is political, because John Adams knows that he's got to get Southern support. And what better way to get support is to send Washington, make General Washington, or General Washington, your commanding officer, a Virginian, and send him up to Boston to create this army, which many, many different traumatic situations are involved with that. Washington then goes to Boston. He gets there July 2nd. He has tremendous problems that he's got to deal with. He's got to create him a standing army, which he doesn't really get till Valley Forge 2.5 years later. He's got to win over the hearts of these militia, because they're all the command of their local leaders. He's got to create an army, which means you need to have uniforms, weapons, gunpowder, supplies, cannons, which he doesn't have at this point. So as he begins to work on this, he realizes that what he needs to do is hold the British in Boston, which means he's got to get up on Dorchester Heights, which means how is he going to hold Dorchester Heights? He needs cannons. Well, Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen are the ones who get over to Fort Ticonderoga. They take Fort Ticonderoga without a shot several months before. There's 56 cannons there. They're 300 miles from Boston. Now, who is going to go and get these cannons and bring them over to Boston through the woods, through the wilderness? But Washington needs these cannons to put up on Dorchester Heights and Cambridge to hold the British inside of Boston. It's Henry Knox. Henry Knox volunteers to do the job, to get over to Fort Ticonderoga, to come up with a plan to get those cannons back to Dorchester Heights. So Henry Knox volunteers to do it. There wasn't anybody else who volunteered to do it because they thought it was impossible. He leaves in December. He gets over to Fort Ticonderoga through the woods. He gets these cannons and he mounts them on sleds, waits for a snowfall so he can pull these cannons through the wilderness on sleds. He doesn't lose one cannon. 56 cannons, 300 miles from Boston. By the end of January, he has gotten all those cannons back to Washington to put them up on Dorchester Heights. There are 120,000 pounds of cannons. Henry Knox does not lose one of them and gets them back to Boston for this siege, particularly up on Dorchester Heights. And he's very successful at that. General Washington has the idea that he wants to attack Boston. And fortunately, he listens to his other officers and is talked out of attacking Boston. General Washington, if you attack Boston, you're not only going to take on the British, but you're going to destroy a lot of colonist homes and possibly people that are sympathetic towards our cause. And you're going to cause tremendous damage in Boston in taking on the British. Washington, fortunately, backs away from that. He also wanted to attack New York several times, talked out of that. And he also wanted to attack Philadelphia, and he was talked out of that also, coming out of that thinking where if you attack, you're going to hurt a lot of colonists, which is not going to bode well for your cause. So Washington sits, and he waits, and he has this siege around Boston, and successful because he's able to get those cannons from Fort Ticonderoga. Thank you to Henry Knox. Smallpox breaks out in Boston. And there's a smallpox epidemic in Boston. William Howe knows by March that they have used all the wood they can to cook, and almost all the wood and homes are being destroyed to use for the wood. General Howe knows that he either fights his way out of there or he vacates Boston. And on March 17th, General Howe decides he's going to vacate Boston. All the British are put on British ships. General Howe vacates Boston and takes his army up to Halifax. General Washington, in his very brilliant strategy, does not go into Boston himself. He picks out all the men in the army, the Continental Army and militia, that had smallpox and are now immune to smallpox, to go into Boston because of the smallpox epidemic. And he allows Artemus Ward to lead part of the Continental Army into out to vacated Boston as a major victory. Rather than going in himself, he awards General Artemus Ward to do that, which was honor and respect and bodes well for General Washington, understanding that he still needs to get on the good side of a lot of these colonists. And what better way to do that than to honor their hero, Artemus Ward? A lot of colonists and a lot of the officers believed that the war was over, or this confrontation with Britain was over. They succeeded. The British left. They vacated. They went up to Halifax, and nothing more is going to be done. The king is going to see the error of his ways. Parliament is finally going to agree to let the colonies go and have their own government. And so a lot of officers and colonists believe that, not Washington. Washington was convinced that the British were not going to give up that easily. They were not going to surrender their colonies for a lot of different reasons. And Washington was firmly convinced that the British were coming back with more supplies, with more manpower, to a very strategic area that the British needed to be a supply base. And Washington believed that that was New York City. And that is exactly what happened. Months later, in July and August, the British return. In the meantime, Washington has done everything he can to get his little army and militias to New York and try to fortify New York, which becomes a major disaster. But it is Washington who believes that the British are coming back and they're going to come back to New York. And he was absolutely right. He takes his army to protect New York. And in late August, when the British return, 248 ships, several days of unloading supplies, cannons, and manpower into New York. This was the largest amphibious invasion of the history of the world. When General Howe returns with British military and now Hessians to recontrol the colonies in New York. This was the largest amphibious invasion in the history of the world until D-Day. And so the rest of the war now takes place in New York, then it comes down into the middle colonies, and then it ultimately down into the southern colonies. But this all starts with the acts, Lexington and Concord, Boston Massacre, wanting representation, the siege of Boston, General Washington now becoming the commanding officer during the siege of Boston, and as the war now goes on for several more years to where the British surrender an army at Saratoga, then they surrender another army under Lord George Cornwallis at Yorktown in September of 1781. Then ultimately in 1783, the British signed surrender, and these 13 colonies under the leadership of George Washington and his other generals and the miraculous stories they have now are going to create their own country, which we now, and they decided to call the United States of America. So that's a long but brief history of the Siege of Boston and the importance of it as we're coming up to the anniversary of the siege, and particularly Lexington and Concord. This is 1180 AM WFYL, working for your liberty.